This is CliffCentral.com.
Welcome to the Renegade Report. I'm Jonathan.
And Roman is present. And Jonathan, aren't you happy we live in a monarchy where people threaten to secede and then the president runs over and kisses their shoes to say, no, don't secede, you can keep the land?
Well, I just want everyone to know I now identify as a Zulu man.
Only, so
you can't
only
take,
now.
You can't take my land.
I did it last week already. So oh, you have it far. I just need to get the official headband and then I'm in.
Official headband, is that it?
Yeah. But anyway, but the Zulu King sets a precedent, basically. So if you take my land, I'm going to shoot you, or I'm going to secede. So I think we should all do that. I'm going to create the Republic of...
Ramon.
Or, yeah, Romania's taken, so...
Kabanakia.
The People's Republic of Ramon, located in the middle of Joburg. And anyone who comes in needs to have, like, a very high visa cost associated with it, and then I will confiscate all your vapes.
And you live near the former president, so...
Well, yeah, near the Guptas, actually.
Oh, really? So, you can certainly charge quite a lot.
So, I think that's what we should do. If they pass expropriation, or even before then, just say, if you come here, I'm going to shoot you. If not, I will secede. And they'll come running with their, you know, running to kiss your shoes to say, no, don't secede.
It seems to work. It's interesting, and it'll be interesting to get Legal Mind onto the show at some point, just to discuss how, if in any way, this damages the entire... policy, because instead of now being an expropriation without compensation of all land as Julius wants it to be, where the state will own it, you'll rent it from us, etc., now it's of everyone's land except certain people, which is a clear discrimination. So that'll be interesting to see whether that dents validity.
I just see this whole thing as just a massive fuck up, to be honest. They don't know what they've done. They've opened up Pandora's box.
Now they don't know how to
close
it.
And they're trying to close it, but it's quite a mess, and I'm loving every moment of it.
Well, to discuss the mess in politics in South Africa, and I suppose from his perspective, the ways it's getting fixed or might be fixed, we have a guest in studio. Would you like to introduce our esteemed guest?
Indeed. We have Mr. Galeb Kachalia, DAMP, ran for mayor of Ekurhuleni, I believe, in 2014?
2016,
yeah.
2016, yes.
And narrowly missed it, 1.something%.
Yeah, by 4 votes in the mayoral election, and we certainly got them way down below 50%, the ANC below 50%.
Very disappointing, because if any municipality could probably do with a change in government, Ekurhuleni seems to be one begging for it.
Well, I mean, if we had got all 3 big metros in the province, then the taps would have been completely closed for the ANC in terms of money for slush money and the like.
Mm.
And that would have changed things substantially.
The guy who is involved there now is a bit of a dodgy fellow, if I can put it in that sense.
Well, he's
a
Zuma.
Some allegations.
Maybe. He's a Zuma man.
Mm.
Always has been. He said he'd resign if Cyril won. He didn't, clearly. He's just busy mismanaging and siphoning off hugely.
As much as he can get.
And when he's not doing that, he's making provocative racial statements and the like.
Yeah.
Yeah, so interesting about you, Galeb. Your family, the Kachalia name, is actually quite well known in South Africa. I mean, your family is basically ANC royalty. During the course of the 20th century?
Yeah, look, the Kachalia name goes back a long time. I mean, I don't know that people necessarily know, but both my grandfathers were close associates of Mahatma Gandhi at the turn of the century. Gandhi was secretary of the British Indian Association, and both my grandparents were successively chairman of the British Indian Association. They participated in the passive resistance campaigns, went to jail, and then successive generations of Kachalias have been involved in what is called the struggle and subsequently in politics until today.
Do you think some of that's being lost in the history? You know, and recently we, as in, by example, we've had Julius Malema making inflammatory statements, the EFF leaders, in fact, making inflammatory statements about Indians and their role in South Africa. Certainly not giving that impression, not giving the impression that many Indians certainly suffered during apartheid and before apartheid even.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, and I've tried to put the record straight. I wrote a lengthy reply to Dalu Mpofu's appalling piece of nonsense in the Daily Maverick, and I gave him a history lesson. I hope many people read it, but the readership is small. But I said exactly that. I mean, and people forget, you know, that Indians were imported here in large measure as indentured laborers. That was a kind of form of slavery, if you like.
Absolutely.
And they were, and people forget, they were forced to carry passes. They lived pretty grim lives, and they reacted against it, and then they threw in their lot because, you know, oppressed folk will seek other oppressed folk to find common cause against who the hell's oppressing them.
What do you make of the revisionist history? I mean, this happens not only with Indians and not only with recent statements. We know the IFP's history has largely been wiped out from the record books. The PAC's history has been wiped out to a large extent. Is it a Black Consciousness Movement? To some extent, they've picked things that they want out of it. But there's a lot of, and certainly there were even people on whites who were a part of the struggle as well. You know, there was a lot of diversity, inverted commas, in that period of time, and the victors write history, so to speak, and now under pressure, those victors are kind of really rewriting it to be a very narrow band of who contributed to some of the great successes that this country actually has seen.
It's a great sadness, particularly for me. I mean, my training is in history. I'm an historian by training, and it's a great sadness to me. I witness it. It's certainly happening. It doesn't happen only in South Africa. It happens across, as you say, the victors often rewrite history, and that's a sadness. It doesn't have to be that way. In sophisticated, and I would use the word advisedly, democracies, when people win successive victories at the polls, they don't rewrite history, they build on it. One day we'll get there.
Yeah, but anyone who might be interested in that period of history will be raising other aspects of the struggle. The ANC had a people's war against the IFP. I mean, the ANC knew that when negotiations came, they had to be the ones at the table, and only them, as a representative of the oppressed masses of South Africa. So the ANC took active steps to destroy the opponents when that time came.
Okay, it was a bun fight, and everyone was vying for the largest share at the table. The ANC was appallingly vociferous, strong, and strong-armed in its efforts. The IFP were no angels in that regard either.
Sure.
There were a few angels, but they get pushed into the corners.
I think they're called sellouts these days.
Stratcom.
Stratcom, yes. Mm. Stratcom. So growing up in an activist family, I mean, I assume that your childhood was anything but quaint.
Look, it was a very interesting childhood. I mean, we took it for granted that our parents were struggling for, as it was called, fighting for freedom. We all did. We wore our privations as a badge of honor. When our parents were arrested, we were proud. It wasn't pleasant, but we were proud. When the security police harassed us, we fought back and did so vociferously and loudly. It was part and parcel of how we grew up. When I had to leave and go and spend almost 10 years outside the country because my education was being messed with and I didn't see my parents for that period of time, it was something we dealt with. I've I'm a hoarder, I'm a historian, so I collect all the papers and the letters and the like. And I was going through all the letters the other day, which I filed dutifully from my father to me and so on. And those are things you build on. You look back at that and you say, wow, this is how we coped with it. The family held together. We communicated. We built on that. And here we are.
If I may ask, in terms of your family, what were those key principles that they fought for? So was it ideological, so to speak, or was it just a more classic democratic ideal?
Well, it starts clearly with you being told and treated by others saying that you're less than you are. So as my father always said, you know, if you accept that, then you might as well accept death. He says, in struggle there's life, and you must struggle for what's right. So you begin struggling and opposing people who oppress you, who make you less than you are. Then you don't operate in a vacuum. You operate in an historical epoch. At the turn of the century, when my grandparents were active, they were operating within the context of the British Empire. They initially sought redress within empire, as did Gandhi. When they found out that it was not possible to do so, as did Gandhi later on, Gandhi broke the back of the British Empire in India. My parents grew up in that period of the 40s and 50s around with the war, the Second World War in the middle. And the Second World War was a defining moment for them. It was a battle. It was a battle against the Allies, against Nazism. And they obviously, they threw their lot in with the Allies, not with the Nazis. And the Allies were a mixed bunch. And then in the post-war era, rightly or wrongly, there was a split between the communist bloc and the West, if you like. And the West wasn't exactly particularly supportive of the struggles of people against oppression, and kind of opportunistically, in many ways, the Soviet bloc jumped in. And when days were dark and friends were few, people were kind of drawn into that milieu. And some of them were drawn into it with blinkers and couldn't see the wood for the trees. I think my parents were different. I think they saw the wood for the trees. They understood the help that was received, and they also understood the folly of the system that was behind it, and then we got deliverance, if you like, in 1994. It wasn't necessarily. We talked about earlier on the various people at the table elbowing for positions, but it's not necessarily those people who only brought about change in this country. This country's change was brought about the fact that the Berlin Wall fell. That's why we got change in this country, because there was no Roy Khafar anymore.
Yeah.
And then things began to change rather quickly, alongside other things which were happening internally.
Sure. Economics often has a large role to play in many parts of the world and political change.
And it's often
underestimated in that respect.
Yeah, but it's quite strange how humans can adapt to internal politics quite quickly. I mean, you see people in Syria now that are sitting on the beach having cocktails while 5 kilometers away they're bombing the shit out of the other part of the city, and absolutely, they're like, well,
yeah.
Such is life. Humans are very adaptive. You skipped a little bit over that period. You say we get to 94 and we get the salvation. There's a lot that happens before then.
Yes.
You were probably what, in your late teens, and then your 20s and 30s before that.
I was born in the middle of the 50s.
Okay.
So when I left South Africa, effectively, I first left to go to Swaziland to study. Then that window was closed on me. And then around about the age of 15 and a half or something, which was in the beginning of the 70s,
yeah.
I went to England and I stayed there for 10 years.
Mm. And then came back, what, early 80s?
I came back in 1980.
Okay, and that was quite a tumultuous time, that last sort of 10 years before sort of things started moving. I think 88, 89 would have been when stuff changed.
Yeah, I mean, I came back and I got involved in politics. It was what we did. And I engaged in opposition to the Group Areas Act and against the tricameral system as it was then and so on, and was arrested and put in, interrogated, spent a couple of nights in jail here and there, but wasn't anything to write home about. And then I spent some time as a radio journalist for Capital Radio in those days, which was the kind of pioneering radio station. It was kind of cool. And then I went to university again to do my law degree. I was in my class were people like Tony Leon and so on. I mean, we were all in the same class. I spent more, those were heady days. I spent more time on the streets and in John Foster Square than I did in the classroom. So there came a point when I packed in the law and I decided that I was going to go into business, which I then did.
Tell me, when your involvement was this with the ANC formally at the time?
No, I was never formally involved in the ANC. I mean, we grew up in that milieu. My father was secretary of the South African Indian Congress. The South African Indian Congress was part of the Congress Alliance in those days, and I grew up in that milieu. As I said, I never joined any particular organization ever until I joined the DA. I never joined any particular organization. I was kind of on the side in my mind of what was right, whether the people who flanked me or about on this side or on that side, who were on the side of right as I perceived it, whether they were the UDF or whether they were the ANC or whether they were the Black Consciousness Movement. We were all in it together.
Yeah.
And, you know,
that's a bit like Leon Lowe was on the show two years ago at this stage. And he says, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s, the ANC was really like a wide, huge tent. You could be anarcho-libertarian, or you could be like hardcore communist, and you could still wish to have the same things happen under the wide ambit of the ANC back then.
Yeah, except those who were behind the machinations of the ANC, the hardcore ideologues had very different and very defined views. Yeah. I was aware of that, and I always was never part of that.
So after 94, there was a period of time, perhaps under the Mandela presidency, where it really felt politics was actually very, I wouldn't use the word polite, but it was convivial.
Well, I mean, Mandela appointed a cabinet made up of people from several different parties.
But he asked Tony Leon to join.
It was a coalition government when it didn't need to be, essentially.
He asked Tony Leon to join the ANC, and Tony said, I'd rather be in the opposition because it's what makes good democracy, etc. Since then, there's been like just a great polarization throughout the political sphere, so to speak.
Well, we look at those early days and they were marked by Mandela and a kind of strive for reconciliation, the government of national unity, a kind of his initial. I mean, my mom talks about, you know, in her book about when he asked her to her and Albertina Sisulu to arrange a trip and to go and visit all the former Nat leaders' wives in Orania, and my mother was saying, why the hell should I do this? And then he said, no, you got to do it. So she did it, and she went. And that was Mandela. He was reaching out to Betsy Verwoerd. It was reconciliation 101. It was textbook, wonderful, beautiful stuff. It was the stuff we could have built a nation on. But then, you know, economics gets in the way, and people begin to carve or see areas that they can carve for themselves, and they reckon that they need to have this, and it's always a kind of zero sum game, one at the expense of another, and then the slide begins. Add into that corruption, and you got a cocktail which rendered us in the space we find ourselves.
I mean, ironically, do you think that the reconciliation game could still be ongoing till today? Do you think the ANC would ever dip below, like, you know, 65% of the vote if they just carried on with that reconciliation inclusiveness type of messaging?
I mean, there would have always been ideological opposition to the aspects of the ANC. But if the ANC continued down a reconciliatory path, if it continued down that path and it continued down a path in parallel of realpolitik, where it said, I have to engage the world in terms of the market economy,
yeah,
and reconciliation on the one side and the market economy on the other side, and we travel down this dual road, I think most people would have said,
yeah,
this is okay.
It's a potent cocktail.
Yeah.
It's a potent, and I think that's what the DA is trying to do,
yeah,
albeit in a way that, well, we have our problems with the DA, but I mean, as a DA MP, so you joined the DA in an official capacity, the first time you ever joined a political organization. What made you do that?
You know, in the post-Mandela era, starting with Thabo Mbeki, when Thabo Mbeki was part of his sort of AIDS debacle, and then the beginnings of the arm scandal, which actually went a little bit earlier towards the end of Mandela's presidency as well. There was a degree of disillusionment for me. I realized that things were going south, as it were, that this corruption was taking root. And the roots of the corruption were very simple as far as the ANC was concerned. It was an ideology apart. It was just very simply, here's some very lucrative ways of making money. We cut corners, to put it mildly. Go and make money. You can keep a bit for yourself as long as you give to Caesar what's due to Caesar, and we'll run the country on the basis of that.
Yeah.
And I saw that and I thought, jeepers, this is a recipe for madness. It's only going to get worse. And it did. It got successful.
For sure.
Yeah.
We're at that point now. Because I think most people can agree that the sort of theft and stealing that happened from the government coffers, to speak, was sustainable for a period of time until it became unsustainable. And we're seeing that now with, pricing moving out of control, government state-owned enterprises now no longer coping. There was always corruption, but it just got so bad. Unfortunately, now the government is starting to seek new avenues of trying to make the same money they were making before. I think that's where the land is born out of.
But to get back to your point, I got disillusioned. I saw this happening during that period. So from a period of 94 onwards of voting for the ANC, both nationally and provincially and in municipal elections, I began to think, no, I'm not going to continue doing this. This is not right. So I would split my vote. I would vote on a provincial vote differently from a national vote. And then there came a point where I said, the hell with this. I'm not voting for these buggers at all. And I started voting for the opposition. Enter Zuma and the ugliness and the manifestation of madness that we saw.
Makes it far easier,
And then I go, okay, something needs to be done here. People are talking about getting rid of Zuma. I need to join a coalition of the willing to kind of deal with this madness, to throw my lot in and to say, how can I help contribute to stave off this craziness, this madness? And I had discussions with a number of people, including the DA, about doing exactly that, being part of a coalition of the willing, if you like, to do exactly that. And then one thing led to another, and the choice was on the table. Do I join the DA? The election was looming, the municipal elections. Do I participate in that? And one thing led to another, and here I am, a DA MP today.
And so we are probably, okay, Jonathan is like a DA voter. I don't vote on principle because I'm an anarchist of sorts. So we have a lot of criticisms of the DA. But then again, it's very easy to criticize, and we get that. Looking outwards, we see a few things. In the inner machinations of politics, is it actually simple to actually do anything? Or is it just so complicated and so bound by rules that, you know, inevitably all you do is stumble around looking for a solution that might not ever occur, so to speak?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think we you know, we've got an election coming. The DA is not in the currently in the strongest position that it ever was because of a bunch of internal ructions which have damaged the party. But that can be changed. I mean, you can build momentum and you can move forward. And when momentum builds, and if you build it correctly, you can go places on the wave of that momentum. Now, if you get to a position where you are, and I hope we do, get to a position where we are in co-governance, because let's understand, we're not going to be immediately in 100% majoritarian governance. There's the way of the world actually is moving towards co-governance. Yeah. It's not necessarily a bad thing. It teaches people how to work creatively and properly on the table and cooperate and to understand what can be done and what can't be done.
And prevents the crazies
from going implementing stuff. Nuts. And it also focuses on the realities of what can be done, because you say, you know, you have these arguments and it boils down to economics, and you say, you know, can we afford it? Should we afford it? Where are we going with this? Why are we doing it? What are the implications of this? What are the implications non-economically? What are the implications on individual freedom? What are the implications on minorities? How does it play out across all these parameters? And you have those discussions, and intelligent people elected to do those things then are forced to have those discussions. Not a bad thing. If we get there, I think that'll be good.
All right. Reasonably, though, the DA's had, as you mentioned, you did move past it quite quickly, internal ructions.
Yeah.
From our perspective, it seems like a lot of these things are unnecessary. So the DA tends to, there's two things that happen. One is they make big mountains out of molehills. And the other thing is that the media is just waiting to make those mountains out of those molehills. They can't wait. The DA, in my opinion, certainly gets far more negative press coverage than any other party. When they are covered, it's almost always in a negative light or in a comparative light to another party. Whereas the EFF only exists thanks to the media, in my opinion.
Well, that's changing, thankfully, sort of. Mm,
sort of. Do you think there needs to be, because we've said it on the show, I'd love a DA that sort of said, this is what we stand for. We're a liberal party. This is what this means. X, Y, and Z. That's our interpretation of the liberalism and what we see for South Africa, which I think in some respects the DA has been quite good at in terms of their messaging, in some respects. But then they get thrown off course. They get thrown off course by Helen Zillesen's one. Really, I still think it was quite an innocuous tweet. It's still being misrepresented to this day, now by the public protector as a clear election strategy, and then by the Mail and Guardian.
Sorry, and then that gets reported on, and public protector's misrepresentation is repeated in the media.
Yeah,
and like you just can't get a break.
By the time it's all said and done, the person on the street thinks that the wrong story is the truth when that's not the case. And there's not enough sort of steadfastness from the DA to say, look, this is what we stand for. If you don't like it, don't vote for us. There was always this danger. We had a good friend of yours, a campaign manager, Ashor Sarapin, in studio before. We've had other members of the DA, Zach Mbele, and quite a couple, Helen herself. And, you know, it just seems that you're all very good at knowing what you stand for. But then when the messaging comes out from the party, there's a lot of dilly-dallying and, we don't want to offend anyone and step on toes because we're trying to get to this majority. And if we upset people, we won't get to the majority. What do you feel about that approach?
Well, look, I've always made exactly plain my feelings. I think that I'm no fan of Jeremy Corbyn. But Jeremy Corbyn actually has done something. He stood by what he believes in, whether you like it or not.
Mm-hmm.
He stood by what he believes in, and that's paid dividends for him in terms of how he's grown, that people have actually, with whom his message has resonated, have grown and is cemented and solidified to the point where he may be the next Prime Minister of the UK, who knows. The point is, if you stand by what you believe and you don't play into expediency,
agreed,
then you're on a strong wicket.
Mm-hmm.
It may not pay dividends in the short time frame of tomorrow. But politics is a long game, and you can build on this. And that's where you don't sell your values. That's where you don't muddy the waters. That's where you create the blue water between yourself and the ANC. That's where you stand for what you believe is right. That's where you differentiate yourself. And that's how you build a constituency. And you jointly get together with people, your voting population, those who support you, engage in conversation with them about the core issues and the core values,
mm.
and that's how you move forward.
Okay, so well said, and I agree with you, and Jeremy Corbyn builds a brand on one side, and Jacob Rees-Mogg, for the exact same reason, builds a brand on the other side.
Is in the middle scuffling about.
Yeah, and Theresa May is disrespected basically because she one day looks like she's Jeremy Corbyn and another day she looks like she's Jacob Rees-Mogg. She just stood somewhere.
Yeah.
People might respect her. Okay, so fine. I agree with all of that. What then do you think the DA should be, and maybe they are already in some areas, should be really focusing on as their policies? Because in South Africa, if you listen to our mainstream talk radio, read our newspapers, you'd believe our biggest problem is that everybody hates each other, obviously, along racial lines usually, and that's what we really need to deal with. Neither of us believe that. The survey data, polling data, none of it seems to support that as a larger context. Obviously, there are isolated incidents. What should we focus on? What should we be talking about at our dinner tables? What should we be reading in the Mail and Guardian?
It's the economy, stupid, as someone once said.
Mm.
That's what it is. Because if you grow this economy, then you dent this massive 10 million unemployment that we have. If you don't do that, we're in deep trouble. Now, in order to grow the economy and dent this unemployment, there are a couple of hurdles which you have to deal with. You have to deal with idiotic labor legislation. You have to grow an economy and embrace a market economy. You have to woo and bring in foreign direct investment. That has its own set of issues. People are not going to come from outside and put money here while you're expropriating land, to use one absurd example.
Or any private property.
Or any private property. So you've got to create an enabling environment and a conducive environment for that. You've got to grow small businesses here. You've got to make it good for small businesses to grow. Remove that idiotic red tape that prevents them from doing so. You've got to give incentives to that kind of thing. You've got to ensure that all those things happen. And if you push those policies and you make that environment particularly enabling, you'll get there. Then you've actually got to say, well, also, now 25 years down the line, if people take risk, do things in the economy to get places, they must benefit from what they receive. Let's not take away bits from X to give to Y on the basis of I don't know what.
Well, that's the market economy you talk about. I mean, a free market, that's the whole point of it. It benefits people who take risk.
Yeah, absolutely. And then so then we have to deal with some very thorny issues. Black economic empowerment, for example.
Yeah.
Well, look at black economic empowerment. A, it's been an abject failure. All it's done is create another band of elites by political fiat.
Mm.
And that's not particularly helped the economy massively. It's not helped the ordinary South Africans, and it create, and we still have a powerless economy with 10 million unemployed. And I'm not even talking corruption here. That's just another story, another layer on top of it, which is completely mad. So you grasp that particular little. When people begin to work, when they have work, when they have a stake in the economy, when they're earning money for themselves, when they're reinvesting their money, when they're doing all those good things, and then they sit across and I say, I've made some money, I'm going to co-invest. Hey, Jonathan, you've got a good radio station here. Can we get together? Race doesn't enter into it. Then we're talking about how we're going to build this unit.
And both benefits.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mm. So why isn't the DA talking about that?
Well, they are and they aren't. I mean, I think there are people in the DA who are firmly believe that, and it's certainly part of the narrative of the DA. And I think like in all organizations, the DA is not a cocktail party anymore. It's a big party. And you'll get people who have different views, and those views may not always be in sync. The acid test is always to say, well, are those views, any of them, in line with the original values and that have motivated and do motivate the DA? So you've got to have your values down pat, and that we need to do. I think that's absolutely necessary.
Right, because, I mean, from my side, I think out of all the parties that can actually make a difference, the DA is obviously the best choice to vote for, and because they're sort of like at 30% of what I believe in, so to
speak.
Closest
in the best position.
Yeah.
But it could be so much better. It could be so much better because I think these are universal values.
Yes.
If you take risks, you should be rewarded for it. You should have property rights to the place that you live in. You should. Why do we? I mean, when the leader tweets about white privilege, like, it just drives me crazy because it is the economy. Why are you talking about social science nonsense?
Yeah, I mean, I think those issues need to be dealt with, I don't believe it's correct to juxtapose white privilege with black poverty because I don't think that that's particularly helpful.
Yeah, well, I think Musi needs the same treatment that Helen got because he's off key, off message.
It's just no purpose. It's just what's helpful. So, you know, you gave what probably was there about a 120-second sort of clip, which, if that is what I was hearing from the DA in every interview, and Nick Cleland, I don't know if you've read his book, but it's worthwhile.
Yeah.
And obviously he was involved in communications and messaging in the DA for some time, and was an MP at a point. He just talks about how you have to keep driving the message. And so when he was involved with that, every interview that anyone across the party gave would be about the message. So if you wanted to drive, say they had a clean water message at the time, you know, and someone was going to get interviewed on a talk radio station in the afternoon, drive time, lots of people listening, and they were going to be interviewed about, service delivery protests. They'd start off talking about the service delivery process, and then somewhere in there they'd go, and this is why the DA is so insistent on our clean water initiative. And that's what I'm just not hearing what you're saying. What you're saying is incredibly encouraging, incredibly liberal, the way I think South Africa should be going. The things we should be talking about, as against what Ramon's saying, whereas maybe Musi brings up a point that at some point needs to be dealt with, and we can have a long debate and discussion about it. But if you're trying to move forward as a party, pick a message that resonates with everyone. I think the message of, we need to fix this economy, we need to get out of your way as government. And that's another area of concern for me. There's some people in the DA, I feel like they think they need to not get in your way. They think they need to hold your hand. And I don't want my hand held. And I don't think most people want their hand held.
I agree with you 100%. The liberal message is very clear in my mind. You know, a rising tide lifts all boats.
Mm-hmm.
We live in a country which has got a skewed history. Now, there is a measure of redress that needs to be effected.
Sure.
There's no two ways about that.
Absolutely.
But again, when you go back to the liberal principles, you say, in order to do this, how should we do it? What we should be doing is, in a very intelligently costed way, because you can't spend what you don't have, ensure that you give people the wherewithal to have to access the ladders to the to opportunity, to equal opportunity. Let's not talk about equal outcome, because I'm not interested in that.
No, otherwise you'd vote for Jeremy Corbyn.
My sister and I are different people. We brought up in the same family. We had the same education. But we completely different people with different outcomes. Hallelujah! Thank God for that.
Sure.
The point is, let's give people the equality of opportunity in an intelligently costed way. Now you cannot get there 100%, because I can't fix 100 years of skewed input. I can't give people the social capital that they'd require to get there. But you know what? People are amazing.
Yes,
give them a modicum of stuff. Give them the wherewithal to do so, and you'd be surprised. Hey, how did I end up being me?
Yeah.
I came from a skewed. When I was born in Friedendorp, Fitters, mm-hmm. on 12th Street, Fitters. Across from us were so-called poor whites who lived there. We didn't have a fridge. my mother was a junior school teacher, and my father was full-time in politics. They had, when I was born, because I couldn't, I had some issue about breastfeeding, they had to get their first fridge. That's how poor we were.
Mm.
My parents gave their lives to the struggle in South Africa. But my father also built a business. By sheer application, in the 60s when they clamped down on political activity, he turned his focus into building his business. He did it well because he was a focused and driven man. He didn't take that money and buy Bentleys. He took that money and educated his kids.
Mm.
That's why my sister and I, are in the position we are here today. Now,
but can I suggest that
that
you
should
also,
be everybody?
You also didn't take your poverty, and you also didn't take your circumstance and say, look, I'm a victim of this, and so I'm going to wait here until somebody comes to save me from my victimhood. You said, look, I'm in this shitty circumstance, and I need to make it better. And the only person who really gives a shit about me at the end of the day is me. I mean, that seems to be something that's missing from the national discourse, from many views in terms of millennials. It's a worldwide problem, actually. It's not just a South African one. The word entitlement's been used before and has been very controversial for certain individuals. But that seems to be a problem, that people don't take the same outlook that you have. And how do we change that?
You know, many years ago, I remember as a kid, some American journalists coming to interview my parents, and kids were sitting around the table, and the American journalists were asking us, well, what do you want change, young man? And I was saying, I just want the equality of opportunity. I remember saying it then.
Mm.
I was saying, I don't want anything more. And they were astounded. You don't want more? You don't want like massive redress? You don't want all that kind of stuff? I said, no, I want to be able, there's a Group Areas Act which prevents me from living where I want to. There's a Group Areas Act which prevents me from opening up a business where I want to. There are all these things. Take that away. Give me the opportunity to do stuff and I'll show you what I can do. We can help people as well. We can mentor people. We can assist people. We can do all kinds of stuff to get people there. But you're absolutely right. Let's get this entitlement out of the room, and let's get responsibility back in. Those are key issues.
Two things from me, which is quite interesting. So you thought about equal opportunity even when you were a second-class citizen.
Yeah.
Which is good, of course. And very, unlike other people that we spoke to in the same circumstances. But did you think 94 was a blank slate moment, so to speak? It says, this is what happened. This is what was wrong about it. We're going to do exactly the opposite. We are not going to discriminate against people along racial lines. We are not going to tell people what they are and aren't allowed to do in their businesses and things like that. And have we missed that opportunity as a blank slate moment?
Well, we began like that. And we should have continued like that, but sadly we haven't. And as a result, we find ourselves in the pickle we find ourselves now. I mean, if you continued along those lines, and if you said, sure, there would be impediments. I need to access capital,
sure,
in order to grow a business. Then you deal with that issue. You say, well, actually, if the business case is right, if the people have got some skin on the table in terms of getting their business from plan A to plan B, then let us ensure that they get assisted in terms of a loan, in terms of an equity injection that is fair and that's based not just on the color of their skin, but on the quality of their plan, on how much they're putting, what risk they're taking. Those are the issues that need to be grasped. They haven't.
Sure, but and redistribution also can take place if you open up the market. You know, you people who have wealth, who are historically come from a place where they could do that and against others who couldn't. Redistribute their wealth by employing people, redistribute their wealth by investing in new businesses, redistribute their wealth by buying all kinds of different property. I'm talking about private property in general.
Yeah, creating charitable trusts.
And they redistribute it not by their own will entirely, because the government taxes them and then the fiscus can do whatever the hell it wants
sure,
to with
but,
it. You know?
But a rich person might very well invest in people.
Yes.
And do. That happens all the time. But there are certainly barriers in South Africa making that more and more difficult. And the economic environment is now a barrier in itself in terms of, well, if I put money into this country, is it going to grow at the moment? It's a bit of a concern. The economy's not doing well and all of those things. And I think we've lost sight of those simple things. What I want to know, though, is, I know that the EFF, whenever they get a camera in front of them or a microphone, they say the most radical thing they possibly can. We've criticized them extensively for that. But can you have these more nuanced conversations with Mbuyiseni Ndlozi when you're in parliament and the cameras aren't on and you can just talk to the man?
You can. And you can have it actually if you're dealing with concrete issues around the table. That's where this whole coalition thing gains traction.
Mm.
But you need to do it up front. You can't do it, say, you know, at the end of the day, okay, let them dangle their, let the 8% that they have wag the 30% that you have.
Yes.
And have that discussion up front beforehand. And then you can nail a proper agreement. And you can understand and you can make people understand that it is absolute. Nobody wants to subsidize failure.
Yeah, well, hopefully not.
So, I mean, that would be insane. What you want to do is to create the conditions for success, not subsidize failure. And if you get that right, and you ensure that the correct levers, and what are the levers there? The levers are education. Look at the system. It stinks to high heaven. Fix that to a degree. Ensure that what are the levers that are required, the rungs on the ladder to allow people to get to a modicum, if you like, even a modicum of self-sufficiency where they can access decent opportunities. The other side of subsidizing failure, if you like, is surprise, surprise, rent seeking, because that's the easiest road to go down. Now, you know, you don't have to have a brain to understand that that's a dead end and the other one is the blue sky.
Yeah. And Eskom probably the best example of that
exactly.
At the moment.
So if should the DA do quite well, is there like one radical, bold idea that they have where you think to yourself, yeah, okay, that's pretty good? Because I mean, with respect, it's easy to say, yeah, fix education. Okay. In what way? And you can say, yeah, break the unions and do all that, fine. But is there like a big, bold idea from the DA?
I don't know there's a silver bullet. The silver bullet for me, if you like, as I said before, is a laser-like focus on fixing the economy. Everything else flows from that. In order to fix the economy, you've got to deal with education. So you've got to break the back of SAC2. You've got to ensure that people are educated properly. That's long-term stuff and you need to do it. You cannot grow an economy with people who don't have access to decent health. So you've got to fix the bloody health system. You cannot grow an economy properly if you're underutilizing your human assets. If your human assets are traveling from for the longest period in the morning from their home to their work, it's a complete stupid waste of time. You cannot you cannot utilize assets if you look at assets as problems. If you look at immigrants as the bane of your life, look at these things as opportunities and help from the frame of what drives the economy. That's all that needs to be done, and the examples are there worldwide as to what works and what doesn't work.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you can go down the route of Venezuela or Zimbabwe, or you can take a leaf out of a more successful nation's book.
Yeah.
Your choice.
Like Rwanda. Well, in some aspects. Just trailing.
Okay, so you are running, is this official, by the way?
Yeah.
You are running for, I didn't want to let anything out the bag, for the premier position of Gauteng
for the DA. There's a process which is currently underway, yes, where the DA will choose who will be their yes, candidate.
So a whole bunch of people will say, I'm stepping forward.
Nine people have put their names forward, and there will be a process. We've written assignments, we'll have interviews, we'll do presentations, and then in the wisdom of the party, they'll decide as to who the right person should be. The right person should be very simple. The right person should be a person who is able to win, who has a track record, who can show that they are able to win elections, not with the party machinery behind them.
Yes.
And then that person needs to be able to show that they have the wherewithal to run and to fit for the job on merit. That's all. There's nothing else. So go do your homework, selection panel. See who is capable of doing that. The issues of whether the person is black, blue, orange, or green, lesbian, gay, transgender, or pink, whether they are male or female, doesn't interest me.
Yeah, I would argue it doesn't interest most voters either.
Exactly.
If not all of them.
Yeah.
Come on.
What? Look, it's Gauteng. So, and let's be honest, I think the DA's next best shot of running a province is Gauteng.
Yes.
They've already got Tshwane, they've got Joburg, almost had Ekurhuleni. There's certainly the voter interest and turnout for the DA.
Yeah.
So it's entirely a possibility. What sort of value do you place in Gauteng in terms of the rest of the country?
Sorry, help me understand.
Just because to me it seems as if Gauteng is really the center of South Africa in the sense that if you nuked Gauteng tomorrow and there was nothing left, I'm not sure what would be left of the country. A few Cape Townians who spend 2 hours a day at work and then go to the beach. you know, a couple of farmers across the country.
Gauteng provides 34% of the country's GDP. Its economy is the size of Morocco. It is in the 10 top economies, just the economy of Gauteng, of the whole of Africa. If Gauteng seceded tomorrow, yeah, God forbid.
Yeah. Ramon's just capping. He's in the corner there. God willing.
it would be a powerhouse in its own right in Africa. So you're absolutely right. It is the pulse. It is the center of the economy. It is the urban maelstrom. It is the urban magnet. It is mostly urban. Yes, there's a bit of rural that goes on here, but it is and the way forward is building large, productive cities that can look after their people.
Just seems like this is the engine of the country.
Exactly.
And if we can build capacity. Yeah.
So if you had to rate your colleagues, so Tshwane and Johannesburg, not rate them, but do you think that there has been sufficient time for people to see the DA difference, so to speak?
Well, I think that's
for a provincial level.
I think you know, it's not even been 2 years.
Yeah, that's very
the first year in these municipalities, you're operating off the ANC's previous budget.
Yeah.
And they've only now just begun to pass their own budgets, and they've only just begun to make a mark about what they can do. In the meanwhile, they're cleaning up corruption massively, and they're dealing with massive backlogs. Now, to answer your point, it's been a very short time, you know, and I in many ways, I wish that this election would have come 2 years later or something of the sort, so that we could really showcase what we're doing, because we would then be in a position to say, this is what we have done, judge us on it. And if we've done badly, then we must be punished.
Sure.
Yeah.
Because I mean, I truly think Gauteng is the future because it is urban, and the future of South Africa is urban.
Yeah.
The future of everywhere, really.
Yeah, I mean, there's this thing about land. No one gives a shit. And and Julius and Cyril know that very well. Yeah. No one gives a shit about land. But then the last grasp of populism is always useful. So, I mean, if you take Gauteng, I mean, that's you basically set for a very long time. Or maybe not a very long time. But as for the DA, it's a great coup. And you will have to be quite a modern, flexible party, because an urban center such as Gauteng is the future of South Africa. So you have to be really nimble and flexible with what you do.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no other route. How else are you going to do it? I have to agree with you.
Just on that, if the DA took Gauteng, does that then obviously means that they control the money that comes into Gauteng, which then makes running the municipalities easier, or is that not really how it works?
Well, there's a provincial budget and there's a municipal budget. Mm. They're different. It doesn't flow through the province.
It all comes through Treasury.
Treasury gives the municipalities X. Ekurhuleni has a budget of 40 billion. Province has a budget of 120 billion. And the other municipalities of Joburg and Tshwane have substantially more than Ekurhuleni because they're larger. So that's how money flows. There needs to be a very important measure of cooperative governance, because we have measures in the way we run things that make allowances for cooperative governance, but they need to be more so, because we all need to pull in the same single direction. You can't have national pulling in one way and province pulling in another way, and say Joburg municipality pulling in another way. And yes, Joburg municipality has got the mayor and his mayoral committee have got the unfettered degrees of freedom to do what they want to with their budget.
Yeah.
But you need to work together, because if you're not in sync, well, what the hell are you?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's greater cohesion if the same party controls everything. Yeah. I mean, I was a bit young, but the DA won Cape Town in 2006, I think, with a lot of coalitions in there, and then they won the province in 2009. Is there, based on the data, has there been a marked difference in governance? Has it been much easier now that you got both? I suspect it is.
I think if you speak to people in Cape Town, they'll say exactly that. They'll say yes, of course. When we can work together with province marching to the same tune in the same direction, with the same ethos, with the same governance, with the same lack of tolerance for corruption.
I mean, there's a great Helen Ziller article from a few weeks ago, which said her office was caught out with 76 rand. Of which was a qualified audit.
Misallocated expenses.
Misallocated. And the reason why is because the administrator had to change hotels because it was full or something, so there was an extra cost. And they spent weeks trying to find out how this happened. Yeah. Not, I don't think it was her specifically. It was like the administrator of the province.
But the DABA is differently. I mean, I went with my colleagues to oversight visit of the South African Bureau of Standards the other day, and I didn't bring my pen with me, so I asked for a bit of paper and a pen, and the guy went out and he brought a leather-bound book, and he brought pens for us, a fountain pen and a felt pen, beautiful Balmain pens. So I picked it up and I wrote, and I then tore the paper out of the book, and I left the book behind, and I left the pens behind. And we all did. And they were saying, no, don't you want to take your gifts? This is taxpayers' money there's like 20,000 rands worth of pens sitting on the table. I said, no, we don't do that. But, you know, they don't get that.
Yeah, because that's the way it's been.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Jonathan,
as a DA voter, how do you feel with Mr. Kachalia being in the midst of the party that
much better when I hear talk like that, and much better when I hear that kind of messaging. As I say, I just want that to be all I hear. I really don't even want the DA to even engage some of the other nonsense that's out there. I think there's a lot of noise at the moment, and I think that voters are not stupid. And even, you know, the ones that we're told are stupid because they're poorly educated. But I think that people are people, and they're able to read through things, see through things. And they know when they're being bullshitted. And, you know, you even see it in private organizations that are carrying these mantles for some of the political parties. You see them losing listenership, for example, in the case of radio stations. You see organizations losing membership because they aren't actually the political organizations, but they've decided to take the political organization stance. Yeah. And normal people are rejecting them because they can very easily in a private capacity. I want more of this, please.
I'll see what I can do.
Yeah. So from my side, I would normally charge, but I think if the DA had three key campaigns against the NHI, for property rights and for economic growth, I think that's a winning formula. Yeah. I know it's much more difficult to package it, don't get me wrong.
That sounds like a win.
Especially against the NHI, because the middle class losing healthcare is huge. That's going to be a massive problem.
Well, fix the state healthcare system. It's in the most awful mess before you even think of doing anything else.
Stop killing a whole bunch of people who happen to be mentally handicapped.
Exactly.
And if you can just not do that for a couple of years,
then we can talk about a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Khaleb, thank you very, very much.
Great pleasure.
Really appreciate you coming in.
And and best of luck with your candidacy.
Yeah.
Let's hope the best man or woman or trans person wins, irrespective of their race. And
gender,
anything else. We'll see you in 2019.
Nice to have a DA person in the studio who talks openly about the party and about their views on the party and all of the rest. It's very refreshing.
Thank you so much.
Right. As always, you can find us on Twitter at @Renegade_Report. Khaleb, your Twitter is? I know you're on
at,
there.
At Khaleb Kachalia, I guess.
Yeah, there we go. And anywhere else you want to be found?
Well, I'm on Facebook, I'm on Twitter, and I'm in Parliament.
Yeah. All right. And so, therefore, you can contact him and bug him about stuff. Right. Ramon at Roman Kabanak, myself at Jonathan_Witt. As always, thank you for listening. If you are listening on iTunes, please leave us a rating, whatever that happens to be, and tell us what you think of the show. Thanks so much. We'll catch you next time. Cheers.
This is CliffCentral.com.